those sleigh bells jingling, ring ting tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
Good afternoon. Because we've got the E-Team here, Rick Hogan sitting in for John Williams, the greatest engineer in the world, Bob Ferguson, longtime buddy of mine. We did that morning show for a decade, and my new best friend, Ariel Halpern, fresh from L.A., and wait till you meet the guests. I'm going to tell you that there was a traffic report, I assume, and it was sponsored by Amita Health. Amita Health welcomes Presence Health into its system. Now, Amita Health System is even more accessible, 7,000 doctors at 19 hospitals and 230 outpatient clinics. Amita Health in sickness and in health. Phil Donlan, movie star, movie maker, local boy, making good. Welcome to the show. Merry Christmas and all that jazz.
Exactly. Rick, thanks for having me. I got to tell you, thanks for being a fan.
Well,
you know, I mean, I appreciate it.
Well, but you've also, it's not hard to be a fan of good work. Sure. I mean, it really is. And I've known you and your sometime collaborator, Joe Sikora, from the time you were, in short pants on the
babies.
Chicago stages.
Exactly.
Let's go back, Phil. I mean, you're a local kid, grew up in Bridgeport. Why theater? Why get into theater? Is such a tough profession.
Well, I didn't know that going in. I think if I would have known.
Did your parents tell you? I know your parents. They seem like very smart people.
Yeah. No, they weren't fans in the beginning. I think when I told them I was going to actually do this and go to theater school, they're sort of like, well, we're not like going to pay for that.
Get a job.
So, yeah. So I, fortunately I got a scholarship. So that kind of made that happen. Roosevelt University, the Theater Conservatory, or I think that's what it's called now. It wasn't at the time.
Right.
It was a little more ragtag when I was there.
What had your experience been as a kid with theater? I mean, had you gone to a lot of shows? Had you simply watched TV and said, well, that looks easy?
I had none. I mean, the interview I did with Felix, which we had talked about
the
before,
magazine.
I talked a lot about the influence my dad had just with hanging out with him. I think, like, when my mom was at work, they both worked. And the shows he would watch. So, you know, he had really good taste in TV. At least that's what I remember.
What shows was he watching?
I mean, we were watching Crime Story, Miami Vice, which I was probably too young to be watching.
Right. You had a permissive dad let you watch these shows you shouldn't be watching.
Yeah, but it was good, you know, like Hill Street Blues, but these were the things, and I remember just sort of watching this stuff. And
that's a lot of ensemble work, too, especially in a show like Hill Street Blues. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow, these people are actors, and maybe I could do this.
Yeah, and I think that just made me excited to want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we wrote a script that I wanted to get to George Lucas.
Well, of course.
When I was a kid. So I think I always had this idea that I somehow wanted to get inside
the television
set.
Well, the other great thing is you had, even as a child, these irrational ideas like, Dad, let's write a script and send it to George Lucas.
Exactly.
Well, who's that? He makes Star Wars. He'll make our movie.
Yeah, exactly.
That's good. To be a little irrational is something you need in the business of movie making in Hollywood.
Francis Ford Coppola, he had a great quote, which was something, you know, I'm going to butcher it, but it was something that, like, your naivete is the thing that in the beginning can really carry you ultimately, because when you get in it too much, then you start to know how everything works and you're less willing to take the insane risks.
However, when you were at Roosevelt, you were certainly seduced by the Chicago theater scene. I mean, you were in it at a very, and I suppose it's always been vital, but you got in it at a very vital time.
It was a great time. The 90s in Chicago theater, there was an interesting resurgence. I mean, the guys that I, you know, when I had my theater company, I mean, the guys that would come see my shows would be like Mike Shannon and Nick Offerman and these guys. I mean, they would, you know, and I would go see.
What was your theater company?
It was the Gilead Theater Company.
And what was the philosophy behind Gilead?
Well, we sort of wanted to borrow a little bit from Looking Glass.
Sure.
Which
David
was
Schwimmer's sort of.
Yeah, Schwimmer's, yeah, Schwimmer's who I know
place, yeah.
very well. I think they sort of had more of a they had their ensemble, but they weren't necessarily married to putting their ensemble members in it.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
They were selective about their productions, and the money that they were spending was I mean, and they were still kind of small. They didn't have the space.
Sure, they didn't have the
here.
Water tower space.
They had their offices.
Famously they got for $1 a year at least. Yeah, remember that?
It doesn't help when, I mean, it helps when you're David Schwimmer.
I suppose.
To get it
when
for
you're David Schwimmer and you have all of that money from friends and you get a deal for, yes, we'll give you this space right at Michigan Pearson for $1 a year.
Yeah, Schwimmer checks his bank account and you hear the lady go, you have $80 billion and 3 cents. And then he gets a space for $1.
$1. Yeah, well, where am I going to get that dollar? Yeah. But I mean, there were good people there, and your theater company did well.
We did very well. Yeah, we won a bunch of theater awards. The critics loved us. And when I was here in September with High and Outside at the Siskel, even Janet Davies, I did this thing with her, and she was like, oh, yeah, I remember you did Richard II. I was like, only four people saw that show.
And two were my parents.
Yes, exactly.
Two were my parents. Phil mentioned something called High and Outside, which is his latest film. We'll talk more about that after we get him out of Chicago. So what there was legendarily in the early days of even Steppenwolf, people like Amy Morton and Billy Peterson would go out there for what is called pilot season.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there are 800 pilots being made and cast, and you hope that you're going to be as fortunate, as worthwhile fortunate as Laurie Metcalf and get cast in a show called Roseanne, or John Mahoney and get cast in a show called Frasier. Did you do that?
Oh, yeah. I went out for pilot season. I mean, how I started with pilot season was here in Chicago. I had my agent here. I booked two pilots while I was here, so I would fly out for like the network tests and stuff, and then come back and do my theater. And that's really, I never wanted to live in LA.
Yeah.
I never had any real interest.
You wanted to make a dollar, too.
I wanted to make my money. This is what I thought. I was like, well, it seems that these actors like Laurie Metcalf, Billy Peterson, the people I admire, they go to L.A., they make their money so they can come back and do their theater for no money, because there is no money in theater. And that's all I really wanted to do. But then the William Morris Agency was like, we want to rep you, but you need to like live here. So I made the move. I don't know how I feel about that.
What year was that?
Oh, boy. I think that was around, 2003, 2004.
Okay,
or something.
We haven't been there that long. He is. Phil Donlon is making a mark, and we'll talk about how. He's made his own movie. He is in a spectacular movie called High and Outside, which we'll talk about. And he's making a new movie about which he told me in the so-called green room here that gave me the chills. Just gave me the chills.
By the way, I need a place to stay tonight. Can I just sleep on the couch in the green room?
Well, I think it's booked. I mean, I think they do book this when the Hyatt's filled.
It's an Airbnb.
Here. No, there's a penthouse apartment. Yeah, it's really nice. No one has not been impressed by this. So stay tuned for more with Phil. And watch for Chicago's very own Stories with Mike and Joe. That's Micah Mater and Joe Donlon. Weeknights on WGN TV News at 9. This is Rick Kogan filling in for John Williams, and as I will also on Monday with the legendary, his name is John Cusack, and he was for a long time the priest, first in Park Ridge and then for many, many years at Old St. Pat's. And he's retired, and I'm often fascinated with the notion of a retired priest. Like, what do you do now? What do you do? And he talks a lot about God. Phil Donlon is in the studio, someone whose professional career I have been watching since his theater days in Chicago. The two of the most recent creations of Phil's. And Phil's, unlike a lot of people who went out to L.A. to become actors, Phil aspired to more. I mean, he started a theater company here, and you aspired to more. You made a film that is now available. It's a short film, meaning an hour or so, called Man in the Silo. It is haunting. Shot in Chicago, much of it, with Ernie Hudson of, do you have to say of Ghostbusters fame, or what do you do? Of High and Outside fame, what do you say?
Of High and Outside fame, yeah, let's go with that.
Ernie Hudson.
Ernie will appreciate that.
Ernie Hudson, who is a big deal actor and a real working actor, who's probably been in, 50 films and an equal number of TV shows, will for some reason do anything Phil Donlon asks him to do. Anything.
Poor guy.
It's a burden that he has to carry throughout. Yep. Like, Phil, I've got a real movie over here.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Talk about Man in the Silo, because I reviewed it for the Tribune and found it just haunting and fascinating.
Well, I am always flattered by how much you love it. I mean, it is an odd flick, and it's not for it's not a film that's for everybody. Oh, I mean, I had made it. I had made a short film called Wrestled, which I made for like $2,000. It was like a 15-minute film. And
budget Hollywood.
Yeah, I wrote it, directed it, I started in it, I was running craft services. I shot it here before I went to L.A., and it went to Sundance, and then IFC bought it, and that, and I was like, oh, okay. And then I was like, well, what's the next step? And I was told by mentors of mine, make like a director's calling card.
Yeah.
So that's really all Man in the Silo was originally meant to be, was a director's calling card. That's why it's an hour. So it was very odd. It was, it's very Bergman-esque.
No question.
Fellini-esque. I mean,
it's basically about a guy, a Chicago executive of some sort, who is going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's going crazy in the wake of the death of, I think it was his wife and child,
right?
And he's like living at a farm, and he's having visions. And Ernie Hudson is terrific in it.
Yes,
this thing is now available on Amazon. It's a pretty big hit on Amazon.
Amazon Prime. It's. I mean, I'm very happy to say it's one of the top rated or rented films on Amazon right now. And it's got like on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got like a 92 or 93% or
wow.
something. I don't know. It's interesting. It's especially relevant in the time, the sort of the film culture now, which wasn't the case necessarily when we made it.
Yeah.
And now it's just like hit this amazing right time because we made it years ago.
Well, because I think it's one of the reasons is that everybody in this country thinks they're going as crazy as Ernie Hudson is going in this movie.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's a very timely
yeah.
thing. What it got interest. What was it, a calling card for you? Did it serve as a good calling card? Did you get interest from, you know, major producers and studios, if there even are studios anymore?
I did. So when it was finished, because we were talking about this new film I have in development called The Scenic Route. What that did at the time was it got me directing deals with various sort of mini major studios. So I wrote Scenic Route for our favorite friend in Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein.
Oh my God.
Who's no longer in Hollywood, but he had dimension.
As long as his check didn't bounce.
Yeah. He had Dimension Films, and they were sort of the horror outlet. They were one of my, so I had first look deals, which all that means is that they will listen to any pitch I have, you know, but you have to be careful how often you walk in there with pitches.
Yeah, sure. You can't go in every week and say, hey, I have another monster movie.
Yeah. So I took my first pitch meeting and I said, what are you guys looking for? And there was like three executives and they said what they were looking for. I went home and wrote it. And that's, so anyway, it did serve its purpose in that way. And then of course, if you want to direct a feature, it's easy when you can show them one you've already done.
No question.
Done well.
No question.
So
how did, Phil Starr is in a film called High and Outside, also available on Amazon Prime. It was screened not long ago at the Siskel Film Center. I, too, reviewed that movie, and I think I said something like it is to, if you think of this as a baseball movie, it is to baseball what The Grapes of Wrath is to farming. It's much deeper. It's a real human story. How did that movie come about?
The director, Evald Johnson, who is the son to the legendary Tim Johnson, who he played for the Brewers. So that's when it was he played second base. He was at shortstop for the Brewers. Then a guy named Robin Yount
came,
and he became,
there
and so he was second
Hall
base.
Of fame, yeah.
Yeah. He played in the big leagues for a long time, then managed the Boston Red Sox, the Toronto Blue Jays. And so Evald grew up in the game and he wanted to make what he felt was what, you know, the real story of what, you know, guys go through.
Yeah.
To get to the big leagues. His dad managed in the minor leagues for the Dodgers and, you know, Double A and Triple A. He worked his way up after his playing career. So he saw a lot and he wanted to make a non-romantic baseball film.
Oh, it's non-romantic. Yeah.
Evald saw me and the late Jeffrey Lewis in a play in Hollywood, a Sam Shepard play, Fool for Love.
Yeah.
And Jeff's wife at the time made a comment one night after the play, and Ewald was present for it, she said, "You two should play father and son." And then he sort of wrote the film for us both, which doesn't really ever happen.
It was, no kidding.
You know, it was, I was pretty fortunate and, you know, pretty grateful to Ewald.
Well, Jeffrey Lewis, remind people, if you were able to see Jeffrey Lewis's face, you would go, "Oh my God, I've seen him in, you know, 100 films." He was in he was one of Clint Eastwood's go-to guys.
Yeah, he was best friends with Clint. I mean, you know, High Plains Drifter, Every Which Way You Can, Any Which Way But Loose, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, something like that.
So. He plays in the film a kind of older, very famous ex-ball player who's sort of debilitated. He's kind of falling apart. He's old. He may need advanced care. He's living in a kind of crummy house. Mm-hmm. His kid, played by you, is still trying to make it in the minor leagues and can't.
Well, and that was a part of what he saw. And what, you know, when I did my training for the film, because I trained pretty intensely.
You were something of a ball player, though, you tell me.
I did play it, but I mean, not to the level that I was inserted into for a year and a half, and they made sure I really, you know, got to, I mean, I trained with Roger Clemens and his son.
Sure.
His son very much is like my character. I mean, he's not ever going to make it. He knows that. And it's tough.
It is tough. And there are a number of scenes. This great new Ariel Halpern, who's producing the show today, you sent me three clips saying, "Rick, maybe we could use these." And I'm like, "Well, maybe we can use these, Phil." But some of the clips, as you said, it's like David Mamet on steroids in this
thing. It is.
Yeah. But none of it, having seen the whole film, is out of context or inappropriate to what is going on in the thing, in the show. I mean, it is a tough, tough film. We have one clip, Ariel. I can't remember which one it is.
It's the pawn shop one.
The pawn shop one. At one point, the old man has pawned his World Series rings and a couple of other things just to try to get some money. And at this point in the action, Phil learns about this and goes to the pawn shop to try to get the rings back. Every time you hear a beep, you can imagine what that word is.
I have to listen to this.
Guy came by, sold rings. Thank you.
You a nurse too?
No.
Yeah?
I'm his son.
You don't really favor him. So, the rings. One second. That one. Sell that to me. I'll give you a nice price for that.
I want all the rings back. I want them all back. I want to buy them back.
This is enough. It's not gonna cut it.
Trying to hustle me?
I'll tell you what. I'll give you six for this.
I want all the rings back.
You want all these rings and pay me what I paid for them?
No, this is what you paid!
One second. See this? My friend, you're $5,000 short. We're closing up. Ben Jr. Well, we're closing right now.
No, hang on. How about this? I get the ring. How about this? I take the rings, I get the cash, I come back. I'm going.
It's a great scene, and Ariel Halpern, you're a genius at editing stuff.
By the way, really fast,
sure.
The actor who was in that scene with
right.
me. Chicago guy, Eddie Jemison.
Right.
In all the Ocean's movies and things. Great.
Yeah, it's a great, yeah. and sad. It's a sad scene as well. More with Phil Donlon after the news. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 7:20 on 7:20 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio here with the news, and I can't even tell who it is.
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why.
That is from Santa Claus. That would be from John Williams' new Christmas CD. I'm Rick Hogan filling in for John Williams. He doesn't have a Christmas CD, neither do I, and we're about the only people on the planet who don't have Christmas CDs. Phil Donlon is
I have
in
one,
studio.
By the way.
You do?
Yeah, me and Ernie Hudson.
You and Ernie Hudson. Ernie, I need you to sing for me. Ernie, you got to do me another favor. Uh-huh. We're talking about Phil's incredible ability to put the arm on the star, Ernie Hudson, to work in anything he wants him to work in. He played in we may be able to play this other clip of you as the young, not so young baseball player getting cut from what will likely be the last team he ever plays on.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll play that in a couple of minutes. But what do you think it is about Ernie, I don't know if he comes from a theatrical background. Does he?
He told me that he did do some theater in Detroit, which is where he's from.
He must have that kind of theatrical. You have the feeling that most people in Hollywood who don't have theatrical background and were not part of a struggling ensemble just don't get it, you know?
Yeah, you're right. I agree. I mean, there's, you know, that's the I'll never forget one of my first pilot seasons when I slept on Nick Offerman's couch.
Yeah.
And this is before he was Nick Offerman.
Sure.
And I was still kind of bumping around. And he even said, he's like, we were like drinking one night and, you know, complaining about why we're not booking any work. And he was like, you know, we're trained in like things like Shakespeare and, you know, the great writers of theater. And then we're coming here and we're up against actors who are trained in like hitting marks and reading copy really, really well for like sitcoms. And it is sort of a different,
it's a totally different
two worlds
aesthetic.
Sort of colliding in LA. It's, you know.
Here is, thanks to the great new but immensely talented Ariel Halpern, another clip from High and Outside. This is when you, as a young ball, not so young ball player, going in and being told by the aforementioned Ernie Hudson that you're done.
Yeah.
Hey, Skip.
Come in. Shut the door. Sit in.
Thanks.
So, how's your old man holding up?
He's all right. He's good, you know. Second stroke kind of wiped him out, but he's hanging in there, so.
I'm going to be straight up with you. I got to let you go.
Why?
You're just not getting it done. Billy.
You know, I'm hitting it hard. I'm just hitting it right at him.
I brought you on as a favor to your old man. But you're just at that stage where you're not putting up numbers.
All right, I don't hit 300, don't steal 10 bags, I'll retire.
I'm sorry, Bill. This is it. No. Actually, it does.
You wanted me to fail, now you got what you wanted, so I failed.
I'm releasing you because you can't. You're not hitting. You couldn't hit water.
I've only been thrown out once this year. Once. That's it.
Yeah, you're a base stealer. But correct me if I'm wrong. Hell, you can't steal first base. Am I wrong? Hell, I got a rule book here someplace.
Wait a minute. All right? I'm going to tell you right now. I'm going to...
Sit down!
That is a good scene, and Ariel Halpern is a genius.
What people don't at home just know, there was about 15 to 16
F-words in the whole thing. What is it? You must be so. It must be a joy for you to work with Ernie on a sort of regular basis. What was it like to work with Jeffrey Wolf?
With Jeffrey Lewis?
And he was sick during the filming of this, right, which gives it a sort of, I think, very tragic kind of patina. But he looks old. That's all.
Well, I appreciate you bringing it up because I do. It's something I talk about a lot, and it's a little hard to talk about. But you know, he was dying while we were making the film. We didn't know that. Now we knew that he had health issues, but he wanted to keep working, and I give Evald Johnson a lot of credit because, not, you know, when people make films, they want to see young, pretty people.
Sure.
And the older actors in Hollywood really kind of get put out to pasture.
Unless you're Clint Eastwood in the
Well, he's an exception. I mean,
he's a real exception.
He's like one of three guys gets to do whatever he wants. But other than that, as an older actor, even with a great career like Jeffrey and his daughter being Juliette Lewis, I mean, he's entrenched in the business.
He couldn't,
I mean, no one would give him a job. And he was really sad about it, and Evald really gave him, I mean, the last movie he did before ours was some terrible, awful horror film, which he got fired from.
Ugh.
And he was really, you know, and he had a hard time kind of remembering his lines, and Evald really sort of crafted the days on set around him, which was a beautiful thing to watch.
No kidding.
And Jeff said, he goes, I don't want to stop working. And he literally did work every day up until he died, because I think when we wrapped him, we were still shooting, and I got the call that he passed away.
For an actor, I know I can sense you're getting choked up, but I guess for an actor, that's the way you want to go.
He did want to go that way, and it was great, and we're very happy we got to give that to him, and he gave what a... He told me he wore that performance on his sleeve.
Yeah.
I mean, he always said he was, you know, he was a character guy, and he was always playing characters. And he basically said in so many words to me, I'm really like, a lot of this stuff in this film is hitting close to home for me, and I'm just letting it all hang out. I think it's his swan song performance. You know,
The movie is not yet available on Amazon Prime, but it will be available. It may be released theatrically. It had a wonderful run at the Gene Siskel Film Center on State Street, where I met your folks for the first time. And the reception it has gotten has been tremendous. So
we're very fortunate.
You know, Jeffrey Lewis, you deserved it. You're great. Yep. You're great, great, great in the movie. We will offer you the scoop, the national news about Phil Dunham's new film, that I guess you can shoot a movie fairly fast, and maybe it could be released in 2019, but you're going to start making real progress in the new year, so stay tuned for that. And I'll tell you, professional painting contractors know the importance of choosing a paint company with quality products and expert service. That's why the best painters in Chicagoland go with PPG Paints. Their high-performance paints allow you to get more out of every project, more coverage, and more savings. PPG Paints offer convenient same-day deliveries from 4 a.m. to 8 p.m. to accommodate all of your painting needs. Who paints a house at like 5 o'clock in the morning? That'd be something. Visit ppgpaints.com, find a store near you, and ask a store associate about helping you on your next project. PPG Paints, the official paint of the NHL. They would be like, associate one, come to my house at 4:30. I'll give you some coffee. I'm having some paint delivered at 5. That's a great idea. People are very, very, very busy. We'll be back to talk about Phil Donlan's new film in a couple minutes. Hey there, Rick Kogan filling in for John Williams. Coming up at 2, two of Chicago's most talented visual artists and two really good guys. One I don't know, and the other I feel like I've known since I was born, although he was born after I was born. Tom Bechtel and Tony Fitzpatrick. Phil Donlan is still here. He's going to sit in and listen to Tony and Tom talk, too. Phil, tell people as much as you can or are able about what might be your next project.
The Scenic Route, which will be my next directorial project, which is the one I mentioned, which was with Dimension Films for a bit. And thank God for a great contract by my attorney, so I got it back. this was in their pipeline and it didn't get done and the company sort of fell apart. But so I'm doing that next, and it's a serial killer thriller sort of flipped on its head. So it's sort of, you know, Fincher-esque.
Mm-hmm.
Shining, Kubrick, all of that is sort of thrown in. Of course,
Ernie Hudson is signed to play one of the lead.
He had no choice. You realize this?
Because for this movie, he might be getting paid. Actually,
yeah, he's actually getting paid.
Yeah, that would be a huge inducement for him. Honey, it's that Phil Donlin on the phone again. Don't you answer that, Ernie. Don't you answer that phone.
Yeah, exactly. He's actually going to get paid on this. Yeah,
but there are a lot of people high on this and a lot of people interested in this. And just from what you told me about it, it sounds fascinating.
Well, I showed you the teaser trailer in the green room, which we're still working on. But I'm really, really excited about it. It's a very, very smart film. And it's, you know, when I wrote this thing, I basically, you know, because they wanted a serial killer thriller thing, and it's a genre I really like. And I thought, well, if we're going to do something, we've really got to, like, evolve the genre.
I mean,
let's not just do another one.
Hi,
let's do something.
Another serial killer. He's worse than the last serial killer. Yeah.
I co-wrote this with Christopher Ellis, who I wrote Man in the Silo with as well. So I'm really excited about the prospect of kind of hopefully getting everyone a payday here. I'm producing with a good actor buddy of mine named Matt Monroe. He's assistant to Roland Emmerich, the big studio director out there. So we're sort of, we've got a lot of great people behind it, you know, that are making phone calls for us. We have a bunch of finance companies interested, and you know, we're going after Ethan Hawke for the lead. So
it is an astonishing thing to me about the filmmaking business is how many moving parts or divergent parts have to actually come together to make a movie. It's got to be on some level incredibly frustrating, but now you've been in it for a while, so maybe it's not that frustrating anymore.
Well, I think it's, you know, making a movie is always interesting to me because I think it's somewhat of a miracle when you show up on set.
Agreed.
Because it's weird because it's just like, you know, especially when you're doing stuff on location, it's like one day all like hundreds of people just converge onto a particular location that wasn't there the day before. And then at the end of that day, it's all gone. And it's just I think it's a pretty special thing to get all of that in, you know, all those spokes in the wheel going, let's say. That's probably a better metaphor.
Yeah.
It's almost near impossible.
Well, the other thing that amazes me about movie making, too, is that everybody who is being these spokes in the wheel are all coming there in an attempt to do their best work possible.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. And then you have to ask yourself, well, why was that movie so bad? I mean, it's a weird alchemy. It's like some kind of weird chemistry that has to take place.
Yeah, I think the more you're in this business, I think you realize how hard it is to make something good. Because everybody, I think, gets involved. They see a movie that they love.
Right.
And it's why there's so few movies, like the AFI 100 films list, greatest films. Now, granted, that list could even be expanded to like 500 films,
sure.
But even still, in the span of all of the movies that have been made over time, that's nothing. That's like less than 1%. So it's hard to do something good, which is also why I'm insanely grateful about High and Outside.
Oh, sure.
It's a film that fires on all cylinders, works, has been wonderful, because I've been in a lot of movies that I've, you know, not necessarily been the lead in, but been supporting, and they are dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, I've shown up to premieres, and I've slunk
in
down
mask,
in my seat and tried to make a beeline for the exit door after the thing's over, because I'm like, how did they get it so wrong?
One of the things about you, though, is you still seem not eternally optimistic in a kind of naive way, but terribly optimistic, even in the face of all these possible frustrations and possible disappointments. How do you do that?
Well, I always say the David Mamet quote, which he said to me, well, in class, he said that if you're, and he's written this, I think it, I mean, he said it a lot, but he did say it when I was 19 years old, I guess, and I heard it, and I didn't even know who he was. But he said, if you are prepared for a life of mostly disappointments, you know, sort of peppered with the greatest highs you'll ever feel in your life than stay in this business. And he's right. You know, I mean, it really is mainly mostly disappointments.
Yeah.
With these great rush highs that you get when you, you know, get to do what you, that not many people get to do for a living. And I try to remember that.
How do your parents feel about your career now?
They're very supportive.
Yeah.
Extremely, extremely, extremely supportive. And I love them for that. They're all, they're all brother. Speaking of, by the way, I have to give a quick, congratulations.
Well, here's another actor just coming in the studio.
Are you Mr. Fitzpatrick?
I'm Tony Fitzpatrick.
One calls him.
Joseph Sikora told me to say hello to you.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Mr. Fitzpatrick. Who has ever called you Mr. Fitzpatrick?
The cops.
They do?
Yeah.
They do? Tony is in here. We're joined by Tony.
In court, they call me that. But
you haven't been in court in a long time.
No, not for ages.
Talk to Tom Bechtel is in here, too, one of the great visual artists, not only of Chicago, but of our time.
Hello.
Tony is, too, a visual artist, but he has all sorts of other careers, too. He's an actor. You know him from Patriot.
Well, now you're doing, so you did.
He's the big star of season two.
I'm one of an ensemble
of Steve Conrad's.
Right? Steve's thing. Yeah.
Is Bruce Terrace involved in that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
Bruce
so
is our associate producer.
Here is the small world.
Tell Bruce to get back to me on my audition I sent to him the other. No, seriously, I just read for that, and I'm like waiting to hear.
I think he's in Santa Fe right now.
That's where they're at.
Where they're shooting yet another Steve Conrad project called Our Lady Limited with Ben Kingsley and Jimmy Simpson.
Are you in that?
I think so, yeah. I've been told to stay available, so I think so, yeah.
Tony, don't you often think that your career is an... Tony's been a radio host. He's been a companion of mine at various saloons when he used to drink.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of his great roles. But does your acting career sometimes amaze you? You're so good in Patriot. And it's such a big deal.
You know
deal.
What? It was so beautifully written that I'm shocked at the age of 60. You know, I met you when I was 19. We've known each other 41 years.
But the funny thing is, we're both still alive and walking and basically
there
talking.
There are bookies all over Chicago and Villa Park losing their shirt. I'm amazed to have a second act at this point in
my
life.
Well, you've always been acting. I mean, you've always been acting.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of theater. I've done a lot of little bit parts in movies. And after Steve saw this train, he said, I have something for you.
Which was one of the famous one-man show trilogies, but based on Tony's blog and life.
Yeah, it was kind of a performance piece for theater.
Yeah.
And it was me and Stan Klein, and we did four of them over
the 16th,
5 years.
Fostered and nurtured at the great 16th Street Theater in Berwyn, then going to Steppenwolf.
Annie Filmer and Martha Levy, the two women who I kind of owe my career to.
See, this is not what I want, having all of you in here. And, Tom, I can't wait to talk to you about your art. If Tony will let us.
Yeah.
There's a current show at Tony's Adventureland Gallery on Western Avenue through the end of this month, through next Saturday.
And it's a knockout show.
But the other great thing about Tom's work is I have to believe 90%, because I know everybody who listens to WGN is a New Yorker subscriber, that 90% of you have seen Tom's work. Or if you used to or still get the Tribune, you saw it in the early days. That's where I first encountered it, from a woman named Mayor Early. She said, don't you think this guy's unbelievable? I go, oh my God, we're going to run this? I'm one of the high points in newspapers over the last 20
Absolutely.
Years. I really believe that, Tom. My dream, though, as we end this segment, and you stick around, Phil, because
I'm
you get in on this.
Around.
Because Tony was an eminent radio host here, and it's not
really?
That. It's obviously, listen to me, it's not that hard to do. So this could be another career.
Yeah, amen,
this could be another
really?
Career. Right. Another career for you. But my dream.
Get one your of my... fingers in as many bowls that don't require heavy lifting as possible. That's Tony's philosophy.
And near the end of this show, roughly 3 o'clock, I'm going to put your daughter Gabrielle on
Uh-oh.
The air. to find out. Oh, no, she didn't know you when you drank. So, but she is doing interesting things, too. And she looks great. And I've known her since she was born. My dream, though, is to have a movie starring Phil Donlon and Tony Fitzpatrick. In
We wrote it in the green room.
The Rick Hogan story.
The Rick Hogan story.
Exactly.
We're just bit players in the Rick Hogan story, sir.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to get some news, and then we're going to talk to everybody. Happy holidays, everybody. Rick Hogan filling in for John Williams and sitting here with Phil Donlon, who we heard in the last hour. Tony Fitzpatrick, an actor, activist, writer, autobiographer, visual artist, and more importantly, Tom Bechtel, one of the nation's most compelling visual artists. We will talk about exactly what he does, because you've seen his work in the New Yorker. You used to see it in the Chicago Tribune years ago, and it is now on the walls of one of Tony Fitzpatrick's galleries, Adventureland Gallery at 1513 Northwestern Avenue, just short of North Adam, through the end of the month. It is through next Saturday. Tom, again, I'm amazed. I have never met you in person because we have so many mutual friends, but I've been a great admirer ever since Mayor Early of the Tribune came up and said, "What about this guy? You think we should use this guy?" And I almost fell off my chair. How did this show come to be? I'm very curious about how that works, Tony.
I'd been looking at Tom's drawings for over 20 years.
Sure.
And mostly in the New Yorker. And every once in a while, I would pull Max over and go, "Look what this guy did with Trump. Look what he did with Obama." And after my pal Lou Reed had passed away, I said, "Look at this gorgeous drawing of Lou." And I said, "You know, we should try to get this guy. I don't think he's ever really had a show."
Did you only know him through his work in the New Yorker?
I knew him through his work in the New Yorker, and I knew that he was with Andrew Patner.
Right.
And I knew Andrew real well. I mean, for years, everybody knew Andrew.
Yeah.
You know, and if you didn't know Andrew,
yes,
you
Andrew
didn't really know
Andrew
anybody.
Andrew was a gregarious guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So a couple of years ago, I started pestering Tom for a show, because every week I would look, and very often I would notice he'd draw the same person many different ways. And what appealed to me about his work was the absolute restlessness and spirit of improvisation in every single rendering. It goes back to George Harriman, to James Thurber, to Peter Arno, Saul Steinberg, all of the great litany of New Yorker artists, and he was proud of, and a continuing link in that great tradition.
So, Tom, Tony calls you and says, "Give me some drawings. I want to put them on the wall." What's your immediate reaction?
Well, we had a conversation that went over a period of time, I think, and every time we'd talk, we'd sort of bat it around a little bit, and then all of a sudden, there was a time slot, and. And then we got more into the conversation of well, what do you include actually in a show like this?
How does that work? I've ever been fascinated with how that works, what the collaborative nature of artist and gallery owner. And Tony, in the early days when we used to drink and stuff, had a horrible relationship. So there's a gallery scene here that is...
Well, I should...
He still does.
I mean, I should say, just apropos of that, is that the art world, I feel a little alien to the art world. It's not really a part of... It's a whole nother circus from what I do. So, and Tony, I think, was a very good introduction to that. So that's part. I think that's part of this experience.
See, the interesting thing is your art is as public as it can be because it runs in this revered, justifiably revered magazine. But it also is so time-consuming that I don't think there is a time for you, and I'm making assumptions here, for the kind of self-promotion that many artists need to undertake in order to be at least financially successful.
Right. That's absolutely true.
We didn't have to promote Tom very hard. Everybody knew who he was. The minute we showed the images, they're like, "Oh, my God, yeah."
Yeah.
So it's not like this show was a hard sell to anybody. I mean, people showed up in droves opening night. And from every... there's no one kind of Tom Bechdel fan. I mean, it was a wide swath of humanity, you know? So this was the easiest show to promote we've ever had.
It runs through the end of this month, through Saturday the 29th. We're going to talk to these artists and to Phil Donlon and to Gabrielle Fitzpatrick for the rest of this hour. Me, Rick Hogan, filling in for John Williams. And I'll tell you, hey, Bulls fans, enter your chance. Boy, are there any Bulls fans left? Enter your chance to win the ultimate VIP Bulls night experience at chicagotribune.com/bullsquiz. Courtesy of the Chicago Tribune, I suppose the ultimate VIP package would be you get to play.
They should add the White Sox into that as well.
Well,
just fold that in.
Depends which free agent they get. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm talking to Phil Donlon, Tony Fitzpatrick, and Tom Bechdel. Tom, you have your work up in the gallery at Adventureland, 1513 Northwestern, through the 29th. We were talking kind of a while ago about how you pull together a show. Your career is absolutely fascinating to me. In virtually every story ever written about you, it's this whole notion of the self-taught artist. I mean, Tom Bechdel, a self-taught artist. I am a believer, and I think Tony is too, because we've talked about this, that art is in every child. And it's a matter of either having that art be nurtured from a young age or being told at a young age, no, draw in between the lines here, draw in between the lines. Your mom had kind of impromptu art parties for the family, did she not?
Yes, absolutely. Art was a huge part of our family. And it wasn't just art, it was music and, you know,
politics
and culture and everything. But she would, you know, and this was nothing unusual to me, but she would have us sit around the table and with a manila pad and draw. And that's actually when I created, as it turns out, my first caricature, which was of her. And it's really one of the best things I've ever done.
You still have it?
I do.
She was also the first person to pay you, was she not?
Your
art.
Yes, she got me my first job. At the time we lived in Yellow Springs, Ohio, which is where Antioch College is, and she worked for Antioch, and she put out a student brochure, and she hired me to draw cartoons, and you know, and I can't remember how much I made, but
it doesn't matter.
It was my first professional. Yeah.
Talk to me for a second. You're noted for caricatures now, and as famous for caricatures as was Hirschfeld, I suppose. Maybe not as a.
I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah, who isn't?
Yeah.
And I know that James Thurber inspired you. He also inspired my dad. My dad would do little drawings. I'm a newspaper man, but do little drawings, and that's the first time I ever heard of Thurber's name or saw Thurber's work. How did you started doing work for the Tribune? That's when I first heard your name and saw your work, probably more than 20 years ago.
Right. I was obsessed with the New Yorker cartoonist when I was growing up. My parents subscribed, but they also had collections.
The great collections.
Yeah, collections of
Peter Arno,
Charles Adams, Thurber, Sid Hoff, and so I just poured through those things, and those were some of the most romantic imagery, and it lit me, you know, and I think that that's kind of been a beacon for me, but I was doing other things too. I played the piano, and I danced, and I was I loved school, so I kind of focused on those things, but I always kept drawing. And in the meantime, I, you know, kept this sort of romantic idea of the New Yorker in my head. And so I kept kind of moving toward that. And then I decided to come to Chicago.
Right.
And I thought it would be a good place to
through our mutual friend,
David Sisko.
David Sisko, who is also wildly talented.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah.
And we met in college, and, you know, two guys with an imagination, you know, and
very distinctive styles.
Yeah, very much so. But you know, in some ways, kind of a similar outlook. So then I came to Chicago, and the other thing that was kind of, I think, playing in the background is that I also fell in love with the Second City ethos, you know, Nicholson May and all that stuff, and that sense of improv, and like many people who come to Chicago, what did I do? I studied improv, you know, and so, and that really kind of played into the way I ended up working. And you know,
what were you doing for a living in those days?
I got a job my first day in Chicago as a copywriter for Montgomery Ward, and I was writing television ads.
Wow.
Right. And wow. For those circulars.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
those,
yeah.
And it was bizarre, but it was very colorful, and it was great to observe. And then I was sending out my drawings
to everybody.
I'd put my drawings into I think I somehow I got I saw Mayor Early's name, and so I put my drawings in an envelope and I sent them to her, and she called me back.
She was an art director at the Tribune.
And so I started getting jobs and learning basically my craft, and then I did my first caricature for Advertising Age, and can you believe it?
The Advertising Age, you did a caricature of one of my favorite authors and a great guy, Tom Wolfe.
Right.
And that, in one of the great moments of serendipity I have ever encountered, led to a call from
Chris Curry of The New Yorker.
That's an astonishing, it's sort of like something out of a Frank Capra movie.
I kid you not. And I, you know, to take a call like that, and it's just heart-stopping. But, you know, I thought this is opportunity. This,
well, you also had to think on some level. I mean, I think, because I'm a romantic, you had to think on some level, oh, my God, this was meant to be.
Of course.
Did you?
Yeah.
What was your first assignment for The New Yorker?
I drew David Byrne. Yeah, for the calendar section.
Was it?
And in those days, actually, the way the art was delivered to New York, there was a knock on the door at midnight, and somebody arrived to fly it to New York. So a courier.
Wow.
And yeah.
This is a great story. We're going to talk. I'm keeping these guys. I kept them silent. I kept the two actors yeah. silent, which is very difficult to do. Tom was covering Tony's mouth, and I was covering Phil's mouth. But after we get some commercials and then the news, and then we will all start a conversation about even what makes a creative person. And I think what's interesting about what Tom does is there's got to be a very interesting energy that comes from meeting deadlines. I mean, I remember when overnight reviews at the paper was a very distinct, maybe even unique energy that comes with meeting deadline pressure. So stay tuned. Phil Donlan, Tom Bechtel, Tony Fitzpatrick, and we will get the foreign student, soon to be graduate, up here and near the end of the show to tell us what she's all about. That's right, it is Christmas time. Rick Hogan filling in for John Williams for another 24 minutes. Tom Bechtel just told us about some of his fascinating background that has led him to be among the most revered, I think, artists in this country. Tom, before we let Tony and Phil Donlan talk, talk to me about the difference, if you would, between cartoon and caricature.
Well, they're related.
I agree.
I will call myself alternately a cartoonist or a caricaturist, but I think of, they're both part of a great tradition, a great human tradition, which we were talking about earlier, and that is cave painting, you know, napkin doodling, this desire to scribble and to try to capture very quickly and humorously and aspects of our lives.
What about working under the kind of deadline pressure you've been working under for more than 20 years, where you get a call and they say, Phil Donlan just won an Academy Award and Roger Angel's writing about him because he's a former baseball player.
Right. I think because my work is kind of loose and breezy looking, that a lot of people may not know the kind of pressure that I work under. But often, you know, 45 minutes or an hour, or you know, and I know that I have to do something nice.
It must give you, as it used to give me, doing a vastly different thing, running 800 words in, you know, 45 minutes, or
right.
Nothing will be in the paper. It must give you a like eight cups of espresso.
Yeah, it is. It's a very quick charge, and yeah. you can either run from it or you can embrace it. And I think I quickly decided I was going to embrace it, and it is very good for focusing the mind. And
Tom has a wonderful website, tombachtel.com, TOMBACHTELL.com. But there's also, if you go to the New Yorker and do a search for Bachtel, you will get to see a wonderful, I think, it's a few years old, but a wonderful video that really does explain sort of how it gets behind the mystery of what is entailed in getting these brilliant pieces in the magazine.
Right. There are many, many sketches. And, the magazine sent a camera crew that sat in my office and really began to deconstruct the way I worked. And I was a little embarrassed about it. I thought, oh, no, you're going to show... This is like sausage making. You're going to show this,
but
I think that actually I realize that it's something I shouldn't be ashamed of. That there it involves lots of sketches. That's my sketch process is probably one of the best parts of it to me. It's very exciting. You know, basically I'm getting to know somebody very quickly,
yep.
And I'm studying pictures of them. I'm studying videos. I'm reading about them. I'm looking at them from as many angles as I can, and I'm getting a chance to reflect on them.
Well, and you're making sort of what I think of as sort of visual biographies. That is it. You have absorbed all of this, and this is your impression of them, and this is their biographical sketch. Right. Phil Donlan, in listening to this, this must... I know Tony's given you a card for the Adventureland Gallery at 1513 Northwestern, where Tom's work will be hanging through next Saturday, the 29th. This has got to intrigue you.
Well, during one of the breaks, which is why I asked how your last name is spelled, I looked up your work, and I'm a big fan, and I didn't know it was you. Yeah, so I'm a huge fan.
Tony must be pleased by this show.
I'm thrilled with it, and part of the reason is because we don't often get to see the works of Saul Steinberg or Peter Arno or Tom Bachtel. They're not usually fodder for galleries. And
well, that whole
I find that to be very odd.
Well,
because,
but it goes to the whole rarefied. You, when you first started doing the Cold House exhibit,
yeah.
was in sharp contrast to the rarefied world of Chicago galleries. It's not as rarefied, but it still is it not?
I kind of find what I refer to as the institutional art world is something that's kind of right now, kind of like the rest of the country, hopelessly conflated with fashion, celebrity,
mm-hmm.
and, you know... kind of 31 flavors, you know, whatever is blue chip and moving at the top of the market, it must be good. I mean, HBO had a wonderful documentary on recently,
right.
Called
Still
The Price
on.
Of Everything.
Yeah.
I just kind of want no part of it. I don't any longer give my work for art fairs. I don't allow dealers to show them there. I wanted work that I could connect with, that people kind of see every day and have a cognitive connection to. And Tom's work was like kind of the perfect...
Now you're going to start... Are you going to start...
conduit to that.
Are you going to start twisting his arm to do like a show every year?
It's up to him.
Like I'm not sure. Be the Ernie Hudson of Tony Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, no.
Life.
I mean...
We all need one in our lives.
I think... I would love to see very much this be a gigantically great springboard for Tom to show in a lot of other cities as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, you know, I'd show him next month if he wanted another show.
Tom, but... you do know, and even this show probably didn't do it by itself, but it obviously punctuated that you are world famous. When someone...
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I exist, I spend so much of my time at a drawing table,
yeah.
you know, in a studio, because ultimately it's a solitary activity.
No
and,
question.
And I kind of have to remind myself, look, it is amazing, but this drawing is about to become connected to the whole world, you know? And so...
How many New Yorkers do they print every week, given subscription and the other?
I can't give you an exact number. But
okay, but what I'm saying is like a million people a week.
Well, but the other thing about the New Yorker is the New Yorker must be the most passed along magazine in the same way Tom right. grew up with it in his house.
Yeah,
that's how I got. That's how I got it as a kid. My aunt used to bring them over, give them to my mom, and I looked at the Saul Steinberg covers. That's what it was kind of one of my gateway drugs.
Rick, to answer your question a little better, listening to your process, which I find fascinating because it's tactile. You know, which mm-hmm. is in this world of digital, which I'm not necessarily poo-pooing digital or anything, but it is what it is. All right, but I'm just saying it's rare. There's less of that kind of tactile, like having a record. You don't have that anymore. You just push something on your phone. You don't have the gatefold that you open up. But
it's the evidence of the human hand.
And also the fact that not everything is perfect the minute it's made. I mean, that's one of the right. great things about that video is when you flip through a number, I think it was Will Ferrell or somebody, and said, well, I'll take this chin, and you're folding pieces of paper together. I found it fascinating and hopeful, frankly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was afraid of making mistakes.
Exactly.
But that becomes what it's all about, you know? That's where the ideas come from.
No, I'm serious. That video,
the
and again...
The fear of error is a death of progress.
It's really inspiring. Just go to the New Yorker and search Bechdel, and you'll find it. We got to take a break. I'll talk a little more with these three gentlemen, and we'll get Gabrielle up here to talk about what it's like to go to school in a foreign country and what it's like to grow up as a daughter of Tony Fitzpatrick. Well, no, we can't share much of that. It is the holiday spirit. So we'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back to the last 12 minutes of Rick Hogan filling in for John Williams. I'll be on Monday too with my friend, the retired priest. I'm so fascinated by that concept.
How do you retire?
Exactly.
They kick you out?
That's what it's too. Well, I hope not.
He's not like defrocked or anything.
No,
right?
Not John Cusack, man.
Okay.
John Cusack. That's the voice of Tony Fitzpatrick. Now, is your stuff up at the Dime now?
Yeah, Tony
has two galleries. One features the work of Tom Bechdel. Adventureland Gallery at 15.
And that's actually, Max is the director of that gallery, my son Max.
Max, an actor, also. He runs around the track at the East Bank Club and hits his dad every time he passes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Three or four times every
time. Hey, lardass, walk faster.
And Phil Donlan's in here, too. Phil's High and Outside, baseball. Movie about, in the same way that Grapes of Wrath is a movie about farming. Very emotional, deep movie.
Thank you.
Look for it. It's coming out soon. Gabrielle Fitzpatrick joins us. Gabby, you've been in here. I've known you since you were born. You have been here listening to your dad and Tom and Phil and me talk.
You guys get better every time.
And you're still awake. You're still awake. That's the fascinating thing. You're finishing up your college education.
I am.
In what country?
So I'm in Rome, Italy, and
see, I find it. What are you studying? This is the thing I really like.
So I study international relations.
Meaning what? Meaning
exactly. So that's it.
No, but with the intention, I've been, you know, I watch and donate to various things you do online, with the notion. I mean, literally, it is not to get overly romantic, but it's with the notion of trying to make this world a better place, yes?
Absolutely. I mean, this past summer, and I actually really appreciate your donation.
No.
This past summer, I was working in Greece on the island of Lesbos. It's really close to the Turkish coast, and I was working for an organization called Refugee Rescue, and they do search and rescue operations on the coast, and essentially they're the front line of where a lot of these boats filled with very, very desperate people are coming. to seek asylum, to seek a better life. And so basically this past summer was working with Refugee Rescue, and that's refugeerescue.co if anyone is interested in making a donation to an amazing cause. And working with them was incredible. And I'd been studying migration and the issues of human security involved in it for a while. And so going there and seeing firsthand the situation was
Hard on some level, but knowing you're helping must ameliorate the pain and frustration. I mean, the images that the 30 seconds they'll show on the local news is bad enough, but to be in the middle of it is really something.
To be frank, I think that one of the things that I noticed about some of the people who had been working there for a long time, and then this was in the Aegean Sea, so it's a lot safer of a journey, and you don't see some of the tragedies that are being seen on the Med. Not that they can't happen, and thankfully that there is this NGO presence. It's not as much, and it hasn't in the past year. But essentially, I think that work really it really beats people down. I think one of the things that I noticed with a lot of people who had been working there for a long time was they couldn't find a way to leave, really, and they didn't know when that work ends. And a lot of them went into it, you know, a lot like me, wanting to have a new experience and wanting to
have your eyes open.
Also have to build professional experience as well. I mean, when you're graduating, you have to have things and experience on your resume, and I met so many incredible people who kind of gave up their aspirations, gave up what they were going to be doing with their law degrees to stay there, and it's an incredibly
I'll bet it is. I feel almost terrible talking about movies. And art.
No, yeah, I feel Jesus, so incredibly selfish.
In the realm of art, I think there's so much to be done in,
no question.
In areas, especially where there's situations of vulnerable people. I think about, instead of photos
on your phone. Yeah.
Right. If these conflicts could be covered in a way that protects vulnerable people, that is maybe more ethical than sticking cameras in people's faces as they're getting pulled off of boats. And I think about art being that, that way.
Well, I have often thought, as Tony has, I know, and Phil, and I'm sure Tom too, that art, as much as it gets diminished in, public schools and is not thought of as an essential element of the life of a child. Well, we can do without art, that's fine, we don't have any pencils. It is one of the great mistakes that's being made over the last couple of generations.
Absolutely.
In public schools, art, whether it be filmmaking, acting, collages, caricatures, or cartoons, there is something, don't you all think, gentlemen, that is... Let you go first.
There's something incredibly positive about the making of something, and incredibly empowering, particularly when you're a child, you finish something, when you make pictures, that make people angry, even. You begin to feel some kind of agency.
Yeah.
And when you take that away from kids, you rob them of part of their voice that is not literal.
Well, and certainly you rob them part of their potential too, Tom. Mm-hmm. I know
you rob them of their souls, you know, and because art is it's a manifestation of our existence, and it gives a story and a voice to our experience.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt that art, no matter what the reaction, at its best, allows us to have conversations about difficult topics. I mean, if you remove art, you remove the ability to have a bunch of people come together and have a talk. Like, if you see a movie, then afterwards you are able to then go talk about it. It's a nice, I think taking
it
away
is terrible.
Our pal Studs once told me that history books were filled with the lies we all agreed upon. He said, what they should do, kid, is keep all of the history books full of paintings and artwork made from the age, because you know what? Nobody lies there.
It's true.
Have a lovely holiday, everybody. And I think go out and do yourself a favor. If you haven't shopped yet, go out and buy a piece of art, whether it's a film, whether it's a piece of visual art, whether it's something at 1513 Northwestern Avenue, a Tom Bechtel work at Adventureland Gallery, or a Tony Fitzpatrick work at the adjoining Dime Gallery. On opening night, he did have free beer, but it's not.
We still have free beer. We have a beer sponsor.
Well, that's
if you can't drink it, give it away. If you can't drink it, give it away.
Our pals at Forbidden Root, who have been our beer sponsors since jump, because I designed their beer cans. You come to our joint, you'll get a beer. Believe me, at least one.
Sounds like an honest place to be.
That's the new Santa Claus talking, ladies and gentlemen.
Drink like Tony used to drink. That's what I say.
And good luck to you on that score. Gabby, thank you for joining this thing.
So
and that's very inspiring to me. Tom, it is an unbelievable pleasure to meet you.
Oh, likewise.
Go to Tom Bechtel, that's BACHTELL.com, and also go to NewYorker.com and search that name. You will see a remarkable video that I really, really believe will inspire you no matter what you do for a living. Tony, it is always a treat to see you give the other...
To conspire.
To conspire. And Phil, I cannot wait to get news from you early next year about Ernie Hudson. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Ernie Hudson is finally going to get paid for working with Phil Donlan.
From Phil, no.
One of the great American actors, too.
No kidding.
Ernie.
No
kidding. If forgive me, but my brother just got engaged. I got to give him a big congratulations to Paul and Megan, who just got engaged. So congrats!
Think it'll work
congrats,
out.
Congrats, kids.
Think
oh
it'll
yeah,
work
absolutely.
Out.
She's
okay.
Awesome. Yeah, they got it right.
It's a
they
great
it right.
institution.
You would know
if you
because
belong
he's
in
got,
an institution.
Tony's wife is named Michelle. I sometimes call her the long-suffering saintly Michelle.
Yeah,
she is a wonderful, wonderful.
She has
woman.
Embraced that title as well.